So, you've got four of us today. Me, Fred Deakin, Nat Hunter, Monica Favre, and Jamie Vieck. And between the four of us, you've got two of the founders of Airside. That's me and Nat, who have been here since the early days, 11 years ago when we started. And you've got two of our newest designers. So you've got the old, jaded hacks and the young, fresh recruits. So you're going to get both sides of the story. And, what do we do? There's three core areas we've divided what we do in, or tried to divide. On the left, you've got Airside Design, which is kind of real-world graphic design, print, branding, illustration, kind of tangible, old-fashioned graphic design, that sort of stuff. Up the top is Airside Digital, which is the online stuff, mobile content, websites, virals, digital TV, all that sort of stuff. And then on the right is Airside Productions, which is meant to be the more moving image side of things. So we do animation, we do commercials, we do idents, we do music promos. It's more about the ideas. We're very much an ideas-led company. And that's very dry, that diagram. What we're really about is here, the people at Airside. We've got a very diverse skill set. There's 12 of us. We've slowly evolved over the years and reached 12, which we feel is a good number. And yeah, there's a wide range of different skills there. You know, there's photographers, there's illustrators, there's copywriters, there's all sorts of people in there. And that kind of mesh, that mix is what makes us who we are. And we try to have a quite flat studio hierarchy. It's not a traditional boss and employee situation, we hope. And we're quite a unique, we quite a unique company. We're very proudly based in London. As a result, we get a very unique flavour of work through our door. And it's been pretty good. It's been, you know, we've been lucky. We've been part of the dot-com boom and then part of the bubble that burst recently. And the last 6 months, everything's changed. It's been completely different. We've lost all our big earning clients. They've kind of stopped dishing out lucrative jobs that have kept us going. We've had to be much more nimble, much more diverse, much smaller projects. So far, we haven't had to let anyone go. We haven't had to cut anyone's wages. That's been our goal. So far, so good. Fingers crossed. So we're quite pleased with that. But it is definitely been tough. There's no two ways about it. But we try to keep the quality nonetheless.
Hello, my name is Jamie. I've been at Airside for just over 2 years now. And I'm going to talk to you about Airplot. I particularly like the intricacies of branding and that kind of slightly drier sort of side of design that some people find, you know, maybe a bit too sort of plain and boring. But for some reason, I get very, very into it. And Airplot was an excellent sort of opportunity to kind of get under the skin of a branding identity and kind of do something interesting with it. So this was a kind of... Basically, you may have heard about it in the paper. Greenpeace were sort of coming up with this idea, a plan to occupy a small space of land just outside the village of Sipson in around about Heathrow, and they were going to delay or possibly block the development of the fifth runway, I think it is, for the Heathrow Airport. And they needed something flexible, an identity that they could carry for as long as this campaign continued and kind of take it with them and own it, and something that would become, you know, fairly iconic for what they wanted to do. So this was the land that they occupied. It doesn't look much here. They've done, you know, a lot more nice things with it now. And they, you know, essentially came to us and said, you know, can you give us an identity? But the problem is they were very, very concerned that the government were going to be hearing about this while we were having our meetings. And so we had to refer to this project constantly as Teapot all the way through the meeting process. And so people were wandering around the studio going, have you heard about Teapot? Yes, I've got Teapot sorted out. And people were thinking, my God, I'm going to get some tea. I'll be talking about the thing. I don't understand what's going on. So, you know, through all this secrecy, we managed to sort of bash out a couple of early logo designs. And it wasn't until we started thinking about the idea of fields and how we could abstract these fields into a logo itself that the identity started coming together. So we kind of had this idea for a typeface, but we were deliberately trying to keep away from this whole idea of doing it specifically on the computer because it would look too manufactured, too regimented. And anyone who knows me knows that I kind of break everything and I like to get very messy. So I decided that it would be a good opportunity to kind of create letters out of bits of cardboard and use up all the blue paint that was lying around in the make and do room. So by printing these letters, we were able to create an identity based around a typeface of three weights. Very sort of extra fat, medium, and very, very thin. And together, these sort of like blocks and different letters could be sort of pushed together to create different variations of a logo as though you were looking aerial view of a field from above. And that's kind of led us to our main logo. Taking that further and with our typeface, you can then start to put kind of messages within the logo itself. And so it becomes a very flexible identity that for a campaign is quite different, because usually campaigns were about fists in the air and red colours and people being aggressive. They wanted something a lot more conspiratorial, a lot more sort of passive and kind of nurturing to kind of go with the whole environment. So this is kind of a brief roundup of some of the sort of variations of the logos that we did. And, following from this, we could then sort of start producing message-based sort of logos that don't contain the identity at all, simply because it carries it with the way that it's presented in itself. And this project, for me, has been extremely successful. Just to see the reaction that it's got in the media, how people have adopted it, it's really interesting to see that when, you know, they talk about it and they have pictures on the website, people holding up homemade logos that they've made. It's really nice to see it's kind of got within them. And so, you know, it's been rolled out over their website and it's been onto their uniforms, so they wear it on the field when they're sort of, you know, constructing this sort of air plot area within the land. It made an appearance at Glastonbury. And perhaps most tellingly, it's the other day we were just sitting down and we were contacted by someone completely out of the blue, very randomly, said, "Have you taken a look at this?" And I thought, blimey, they've basically been very inspired by that logo. And I thought, clearly that something successful is going on there.
So I mentioned earlier we had a lot of big jobs that kind of faded away, and this was the kind of last of the big jobs. We do these commercials for Asda. Strangely, I've only got this movie without a soundtrack because we never bothered to go to the agency and ask them for a finished copy to put on our showreel. But there it is, and it was very nice to do, especially when we invoiced them. Yeah, and that was equally nice to invoice for, and... So moving on, MasterCard. This was a big money job we were quite pleased about. And this also ended quite recently. Both Asda and MasterCard were kind of our big earners for quite a while. And MasterCard is a series of illustrations using the MasterCard brand colours of famous locations around the world. And it's rolled out over all the airports worldwide. You rarely go through an international airport without seeing one of these posters. And we didn't do the work in the last 6 months, but we did get paid licensing fees for over the last 6 months because the campaign has run on and on. So it's kept us going through the lean times. That's New York.
And now for my favorite project. So this, if maybe some of you have seen it around, is a project for wallpaper. Basically, it's probably because of my slightly perverted French mind. On my spare time, I like to draw naked ladies. That's what I've been doing for a very long time. And coming to Airside, I actually thought, you know, I found a public. And I'm the only girl designer in a big boys club. And so everyone was happy. And I was drawing these kind of, lesbians, bunnies, enjoying foreplay. And we did that for the shop that Fred was talking about earlier. And it became this, like, screen print with, like, golden leggings, which was quite nice, that got blocked quite a lot. So after that, Wallpaper came to us and said, "Oh, we're planning this sex and art issue, and we saw your alpha bunnies, and we really like them, and we'd like to commission you. No budget, but it's kind of like exposure. You know, it's a really nice opportunity. We'd like you to do an alphabet for us." And so I was really excited. So I went back to drawing board, started sketching for no reasons, which made Alex very happy. And I was kind of looking into, you know, maybe doing something different. You know, I didn't know, honestly, the deadline was really tight, so didn't know if I had the time to do another alphabet because it took ages to do the first one. And, you know, started looking into having pin-up girls kind of making love on top of furniture because Wallpaper is, you know, very fashionable lifestyle magazine. And then I was like, I'm not really sure, and I'm not really sure about that. And then I thought, let's be brave enough and work on my weekends on that and create a whole new set of letters for them, which we did. And basically it made me really happy to kind of, I kept the G, I have to admit, I kept the G because I really like the G. And redesigned the whole set. Yeah, you will see the G in a close-up in a minute. You'll understand why. So yeah, some of them are more, you know, erotic, dance-like, not, you know, you can't see anything anyway, it's all about what you can guess. And the G, which I really like, this tiny bit of negative space on the hand, but there are kids in the room, so I'll go. So these letters are actually much more kinky than the alpha bunnies, which makes me really happy. And they loved it. And wallpaper was really happy. And they were actually so happy that they came back with a bit more money and said, oh, you know, they would look really good animated. Could you do something for our website? And it became this, which was this very simple banner, but that our very talented animator, Mackie, did. And I think it works beautifully. And yeah, I'd love to animate the whole alphabet one day.
So Airside, about 3 years ago, we started becoming much more environmentally aware about everything that we're doing, and we realised that a lot of what our industry creates ends up in landfill, somewhere like that, and we're using a lot of resources, Earth's warming, running out of landfill space. There's quite a lot of motivation, really, to be looking at what we're doing. So we decided we really wanted to clean up our act, and we did all the usual recycling around the studio and that kind of thing. But we wanted to take it further, and it was really difficult to find the right information. We had friends at Greenpeace, and we kept asking people questions, and they were like, oh, yeah, well, I know a bloke. And it was quite hard to find very specific things, like where do you find recycled labels to stick on envelopes and that kind of thing. So I ended up meeting the other two women in that photo, Caroline Clark sitting down and Sophie Thomas standing up, and I met them just at some, I don't know, evening event somewhere, and they knew everything. They know everything. Sophie has lived, run a sustainable design studio for 10 years, and Caroline's, off her own back, made this paper and print database that's really amazing. And so I found myself picking their brains all the time. And we ended up realising there was a big gap. Well, I was going to say gap in the market, but it's not really a money-making thing. But there's a big gap. There's a kind of knowledge gap. So we formed a not-for-profit social enterprise called Three Trees Don't Make a Forest. And the aim is to help designers practice sustainable design. And we realised, the more we looked at it, we realised it's really not about recycled paper, even though that's part of it. You know, how do you find the right recycled paper and everything? It's about the whole process. It's about rethinking what we're making. So it's about everything from redefining the brief when it comes in to designing with the end in mind. You know, when you make a leaflet, is it going to be in landfill in a week's time, or can you do something about it? And in this process of doing our research, we had to get in touch with the production process. So we went to our local paper mill, which was 550 miles away in Scotland. There's only two paper mills left in the country. And we were quite shocked at what a huge, dirty, messy industry it is. When you get a nice little sheet of A4 paper, you don't think about the water and the pulp and the, you know, where things come from. It was, you know, we were going around with earplugs and goggles, and it was really dangerous. And you know. And we appointed a board of experts recently. This is Richard Owers from Beacon Press. He's one of the most environmentally friendly printers in the country. And we had our first board meeting 2 weeks ago, and we've got people from the design industry, from printers, papers. And so the idea is to really get together a kind of serious coalition of people who want to make a difference. And we're running workshops at the Design Council and in other people's studios, and we even did one at Airside last week. And finally, we're in the process of redesigning our website. Our website is very small at the moment, and the idea is to get an online Wikipedia-type thing of all the people who know their stuff really contributing the knowledge so that they can share it with everyone.
So we have an online shop where we put products out there. If one of us gets an idea, we like to kind of do something with it rather than just sit around and wait for a client to come along. So in that instance, it goes on the shop, and we do T-shirts and prints. We do our calendar up there. It's a great kind of way to access our audience directly, and even to have an audience, which is quite unusual, I think, for a design company like us. But yeah, and it gives us a playground so we can try things out and maybe you know, get something right, and then we can sell it to a client afterwards and experiment with format and stuff like that. We do a lot of T-shirts. This is the T-shirt page of the site. Here's some of the designs we've done in the past. And, of course, then we all get free T-shirts, which can be quite embarrassing on some days when we all come in wearing exactly the same T-shirt. Malou had an idea to do some naked cat women, and there it is in a print. This is our biggest seller, which is a print for Battle Royale, which was a film, a Japanese slasher film. And that one is a perennial bestseller. We've done joint ventures with people like EMI Music Publishing, where we came up with an idea together about making art prints out of lyrics for songs, so you could sell to rock and rollers. And this is the Ace of Spades. That's Sam Sparrow, and that's been good fun. And these aren't traditional clients, where a client comes in and says, I've got X amount of money, please do us this. This is more of a kind of entrepreneurial thing. And it just, yeah, it keeps us fresh. These are the stitches, which you can go on our site, and you can't buy the stitches, but you can pay us an adoption fee to adopt a stitch. I could talk a lot about the stitches. Anne is here, who is the mother of the stitches. She's at the back. She will can tell you more later on if you want to know. But basically, people send us photos of their adopted stitches from all over the place. Every year we do a calendar where we collate all the work that we like the best, maybe some of the pitch work didn't get through, and that goes on the shop as well. And yeah, it's a great sort of receptacle for the doodles that we've been kind of inspired by but haven't actually found the way into the real world. But all of this pales into insignificance with Humping Dog. Humping Dog was an idea that Alex had in the pub. Cube Toys had approached us, Cube Toys in Japan, and said, have you got any ideas for USB-related toys? And we came up with really sensible ideas, and then right at the end we went, oh yeah, there's this Humping Dog idea. And this is the very last project we are going to show you, which is the book about Airside, which came out about 3 months ago. It was the idea of our Japanese agent, actually, to do a book about Airside. We do think, we're a very peculiar, unusual company, I think, and hopefully a bit of a flavour of that has come over. So, yeah, we were 10 years old, and we thought we'd do a book, and now we're 11 years old. That's how long it bloody took. It was a long time. But it was worth doing, I think. It kind of encapsulates what we've been about in the last decade. We had three goals. The first goal was to show the work that we've done over these last 10, 11 years. Just simply collect it all so when we're old and grey we can look at it and go, I remember that job. The next goal, I think, was to kind of analyse our process and our method and kind of try and actually encapsulate what it is about us. Because it was a story that just happened to us. You know, we started up a company. Well, you can read all about it in the book if you want to. And the third reason, I think, was to try and provide a case study for people who are trying to set up a graphic studio themselves or trying to do something similar to us. There's a lot of lessons here because we had to learn as we went along on the fly. None of us were natural business people or none of us were any good at running a studio. It kind of just evolved. And we kind of were very, very uncompromising at the beginning. And there was a famous instance when BT phoned us up for some work and we just didn't phone them back. They left a message on our answer machine. We went, we're not working for BT because we're not doing corporate work. Well, as you can see, that's changed. But it's been an interesting journey, you know. And hopefully we've managed to maintain the quality and the personality of Airside without selling out too much. But you can be the judge of that. Here is some development work for the cover. I did the cover. That was my cover. I said, here, cover, here, everyone, the cover's done. It's fantastic. And then everyone went, don't like it. So I had to redo it. It's a humbling experience. We produced it as greenly as possible, because according to our core values, it was printed in Wales, not China. Even though it would have been cheaper in China in the short term, I think it was probably, we saved a lot of shipping costs, and obviously it was greener. And it's all FSC paper, vegetable inks.
I was just going to ask, out of the 12 people that you've got in the studio, how many of them contribute creatively to projects?
It depends what you mean by creatively. The short answer is there's four straightforward designers, one interaction designer, but actually he designs t-shirts as well. So there's five people whose job title has designer in it. And then the three directors who are designers but end up doing a lot of the top level stuff now, so very little hands-on stuff. Well, Fred's a slight exception to that. Well, actually, no, we do hands-on stuff, but not as much as the people who have designer in their title. And then it gets a bit more of a grey area after that. So you've had Colm mentioned a couple of times. Now, Colm came as an accountant, and he now is a copywriter, and he's a brilliant copywriter. And it all came from a year ago. We all sat down and went, like, you know, what do we really, really, really want to do? And he said, I want to write. And then somehow we've managed to kind of give him a little thing, one little thing at a time, and now he's writing whole scripts. So quite a lot of people there, even if they're doing jobs that aren't technically creative, are creative. So Anne, who does our new business in PR, she's the mother of the stitches. She knitted all those stitches. She came up with the idea. And she's a photographer as well in her spare time. So a lot of people have that dual role.
Being a carbon neutral company, does that in any way affect your work in Japan in terms of travel and things?
Very good question. We've planned that it would take 2 weeks to get to Japan by train. We looked into it. We've worked out all the train times. You have to go to Vladivostok or Shanghai, get a boat. And to be honest with you, that's a really, really, really difficult issue at the moment of weighing that up. And I have no answer other than we're working on it. We're working on that moral dilemma of certainly limiting our flights, but at what point do you start cutting them out completely? But a lot of the Japanese stuff we do remotely. So we have video iChats, and that does very well. So you need a few visits to make those personal connections, and then that'll last you for a couple of years of iChats, and then you have to go and have it. Oh, they come over as well. But, yeah, no, it's a good question.
Hi. Just when you were getting started, how did you fund yourselves? Or did you just start out by having clients? What came first, chicken or egg?
Well, you could read about that, of course. In our fantastic Airside book. But to answer briefly, in not enough detail, I'm sure, for your insatiable curiosity, the three of us came together and rented a studio space and sublet the rest of the space to our mates. And the original Airside was simply a place where we went to work that was nice, that wasn't working out of our bedrooms, basically. And we all had a fair amount of freelance work before we came together, so we kind of carried on doing that to support. And then we borrowed from our parents and didn't eat for a while and did a lot of work for free initially. I think the key thing was to get a good portfolio. That was the first mission. In the first 2 years, it was about staying alive and building up a killer portfolio. So when you were in that pitch situation, you knew you'd win. You know, you had the ammunition to win.
I was just going to ask what your thoughts were about free pitching, because we're a small studio, there's only two of us, and because of resources and things like that, we often kind of weigh it up and we think, is it worth it and stuff, and we've done it a few times, but it also feels like you're like giving yourself away for free, and it kind of, it's quite annoying, and I just kind of wondered what you thought about that. And you obviously do it sometimes.
Yeah, we do it sometimes, certainly. Yeah, it's a horrible phrase, the free pitch. There's no two ways about it. I think it is inevitable. It's a similar question to the free, interns. Do you do work experience for nothing? And I think I did work experience for virtually nothing. You've got to do it. It's a case-by-case thing, I think, basically. We still free pitch occasionally, and when we lose, we get very annoyed, don't we?
I was just going to add to that that we've got a way of gauging our chances a bit now, so we've learnt not to pitch without asking how many other people we're pitching against. So you don't want to pitch against more than two or three people. Like, we learnt that from once when we realised we'd pitched against 10 people, and if we'd known that, we never would have done it. And then we always ask for a pitch fee, always, always, always. So because we don't necessarily get it, but it makes them realise that they're asking you to do work. So even if they only give you a couple of hundred quid, they're investing in you and they're serious about it. Because the worst thing about pitches is when someone's just randomly getting a few companies to pitch and they don't really mean it, or the job hasn't quite been decided yet. And those are the ones that really hurt for us.
Yeah. How many people are you pitching against? Can I have a pitch fee, please? Okay, never mind, I'll do it anyway, but I've asked you. And how much is the budget of this job? Is it a real job? And how much will we get paid if we win the pitch? And you always ask those three questions. And then if you feel like doing a free pitch, you do a free pitch. But you have to ask those questions, I think. That would be my watchword.